From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we discuss the recent BBC documentary Murder in Milwaukee. Some of the film's participants are unhappy with the way the city was portrayed.
We all came together to better the area, and a lot of changes happened. A lot of things are different. A lot of the shootings and murders have decreased by 68%, and none of that was depicted.
Then Fit for You explores dynamic running therapy and what it can do for patients.
It's good for anybody, I think. You know, anybody who suffers from anxiety, there's a whole DRT journey. It takes you on a sort of before, middle, and after kind of journey.
And ahead of his Wednesday visit to Milwaukee, we'll chat with cat whisperer Jackson Galaxy about how to best live with the small tigers we call house cats. Lake Effect is next. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Murder in Milwaukee. That's the name of a new documentary from the BBC. The documentary chronicles the Milwaukee Police Department as they work to curb gun violence, and it looks at the relationship between the police and African Americans.
But the depiction of Milwaukee as a lawless city has angered some community activists. WUWM reporters Aisha Turner and Latoya Dennis spoke with two of the people featured in the documentary.
Shonda Payne is an EMT. She also runs Unity in the Community, a grassroots movement to quell gang violence. That work is left out of the BBC documentary. What is included is Payne's own history as a gang member.
And Thaddeus Ashford, who sometimes goes by Taz, he's the cousin of Sylville Smith, the man killed by a police officer in the Sherman Park neighborhood last August.
Just to kind of start off with the two of you, Shonda and Taz, you're both featured pretty heavily in the documentary. And I'm wondering if you all have seen it and what your general reaction was.
I definitely have not watched the documentary. I watched the little snippets, and from that point, really didn't have an interest to go further because it was not featuring me in the best light. So, I mean, why torture myself any further? Taz?
Me personally, I didn't want to see it. I didn't really too much care for it after the fact. I seen all the feedback from me. Like, you know, I just had to vibe off the feedback and then didn't want to see it because it was just seemed like to be a negative thing when it all came to light.
What were people saying to you all about it?
On my end, there was a lot of mixed reviews. A lot of people were, you know, prayers with you and your family, respect you for doing what you're doing to protect your family. Some people where you are utterly ridiculous to have 9 firearms in one house. Some people were, can I have your autograph? Some people were, it was mixed reviews. It wasn't anything that you just want to sit down and dedicate too much time to because it was, you know, I've got a lot of patience, but with some of the comments, you know, they were kind of forcing me back to be that 90s child. I wasn't going in the right direction, so it's better to shut up than say the wrong thing.
What did you think it was going to be, the documentary?
What they portrayed it to be initially was that they were coming about the violence and the things that were happening, but what we thought was going to happen was that they were going to start with, when I initially came to that area and started Unity in the Community, and we all came together to better the area, and a lot of changes happened. A lot of things are different. A lot of the shootings and murders have decreased by 68%, and none of that was depicted. You know, it was stuck on that first initial thing that they all came for, which was how many shootings can we see? How many people can we watch die?
Can you talk a little bit about what unity and community is?
What unity in the community is, being a part of the Vice Lords for 28 years, what I did is I took the initiative to say a lot of the violence was happening between, you know, the two different gangs, you know, senseless, fighting over nothing, pretty much. And watching my kids grow up, and all are mainly boys, and the chances of their survival out here are slim to none if things continue to be the way that they are. So, saying, you know, what part could I do to bring together Growth and Development Vice Lords to say, you know, let's sit down, let's have a round table, let's figure out why, who, what, when, where, and why this is happening. And their people sat down, talked with me. We came to an agreement of a ceasefire. And that changed a lot of things, you know.
Is that something that you talked to the BBC about?
Oh, definitely. But like I said, they took the bits and pieces that they wanted from that. And, you know, it's media, you know. Who's going to watch me cooking rice and reading to my kids? You know, who wants to see that? It was exaggerated. It was sensationalized. We all know Milwaukee has its issues, its problems, but Milwaukee is also a great place, can be a better place, but it takes the grassroots people, Taz, myself, Freedom Fighters, Program the Parks, people with the passion to stick it out.
I was curious how they presented it to you, Taz, the documentary.
Well, they presented it to me as they wanted to, you know, film basically what we was going through, because it basically struck, you know, an ear somewhere in London, and it brought to their attention, you know, what we went through here about us losing Seville, you know, due to police brutality. But, you know, when they start coming with the interview and everything like that, we start doing it, that's when, you know, like, questions start coming out about how many kids you got, how many baby mamas you got, and, like, you know what I mean, do you have guns and all, like, all type of, you know, questions.
Yeah, and so Vaughn Mays Bay, who's a local community activist here and runs Program the Parks, he actually posted the raw footage that he shot of you and Sidan, Seville's brother, being interviewed by the BBC last summer, you know, talking about the fact that at the memorial where you guys were being interviewed, there'd been a really heavy police presence. And you're kind of trying to describe all of the police that are down the street looking at what's going on.
They know it's little too much they can do to me. You know what I mean? All eyes on me. I can't show up in a mugshot, beat up, and they done killed my brother.
Right.
I'm not going to look good.
Right.
So it's not too much they can do, you know what I mean, as far as to me.
We already had conversations with them. But
do you have kids either of you?
Yeah, I got four.
I got two.
I got four boys.
Really?
I got four boys.
4 points.
I stand out here every day
to
make sure.
You're 24 years old.
24. I got four boys.
Are you married?
I'm not married.
Are they with, how many moms?
Four moms.
Damn.
You want to get it personal.
Do you not think it's hard to be a dad to four kids by 4 months?
It is, but at the end of the day, I handle my business. It's how you look at it. You know what I mean? I embrace my kids. And the reason I stand for my brother and how I stand for what I stand for is so the police don't gun my kids down, or my nephew he left behind down, or anybody that stand with me down.
And I wasn't trying to be rude. So I was, you know, trying to just answer the questions as best as I could. But, you know, like I had the eye and I said, you know what, this ain't really, they asking too many, you know, sideline questions. They ain't even really sticking to the main, you know, script. You know, it's a lot of stuff that me personally, that I've been out here doing. We was in Sherman Park a couple months ago and we gave out over 300 some book bags to kids and everything like that. Like, you know, the whole thing was lit to see all them faces and all that, you know what I mean? So, like, it's a lot of stuff we've been doing. Like, we've been doing barbecues where we've been spending our own money and and just giving stuff away. Like, you know what I mean? I still do stuff. I still am going to do stuff. I'm not going to let BBC, some new cast, sit back there and to try to use me to deteriorate my culture, my race, by miss agenda or hidden agenda they try to come over and do. That's not the purpose. That's not what that film was about. That was not what my intentions of being in that film was about. Our intention was to get there, hey, listen, we victims of police brutality and we need to be heard, and we ain't finna back down from this.
Is one of your concerns the fact that it's not that what was highlighted isn't necessarily true, is that none of the positive was shown?
It just none of the positive was there. Like, it was nothing positive was there. Like she said, this
exactly.
She has college, you know, degrees and everything like that. You know, I just posted one of her graduation pictures on my Instagram to post back on Facebook to let them, hey, BBC, y'all didn't include this. You know what I mean? Like, I got accolades that's on my refrigerator that you would think if you walk in my house, my daughter be like, oh, so many awards on this refrigerator. No, them mines. Like, you know what I mean? I got, you know, them me, they didn't include that. You see what I'm saying? I do home health care, anything like that. You know, I've been doing this for a year. You know what I mean? I got four residents that I take care of. They didn't include that. You see what I'm saying? They didn't include a lot of stuff for a fact that we do. They didn't include that we go out here and we patrol, you know, neighborhoods that been victimized by people losing their life and loved ones. And we live in after hours, and we didn't tuck our kids, and we still out here patrolling the streets. They didn't include none of that. You know what I mean? They didn't include nothing in
the community feedings we do, you know, weekly, and it's out of our own pockets. We get no funds from the state. We get no funds from anywhere. It's all collaboration of Taz, myself, Freedom Fighters, Program the Parks. We all, if one of us is doing something, we all come together and look out for one another. You know, we cook dishes, we go buy food, we hand it out, we, with nothing asked back in return. It's just, you know, and we're not looking for somebody to pat us on the back. It's just, don't project us as gun-toting, you know, thuggish, ruggish, you know, people. We all are very passionate about what we're doing, how we're doing it, and that's what matters to us.
Why does the outside perception matter? Like, if people watch this film, right, and they're going to, because it's like such a negative portrayal, they're obviously going to think negative things. What impact does that then have?
That guy has, for a fact, has 1.7 million followers. That's just on Twitter. So if he had 1.7 million followers, just think how many followers or people have seen that. For a fact, I would think in that day or within 48 hours, that film already reached 5 million viewers.
8 million. 8.
We'll see it ballpark 8 million. 5, well, 8. But and the thing about it is, you never know what type of resources that we could have got from any other country or anybody else that was on the outs that can help us with anything, but look at the image they're going to portray. You trying to help them, what they going to do? Oh, well, this is what they doing with the money. They having babies. They commit murders. They selling drugs. They
buying
toting guns. Like, this is what they doing. So you got to understand, a lot of foreign countries, when then you got to understand, if it's not this, if Milwaukee or Wisconsin they want to help, just think, that's a foreign country. They might not want to send any of their imports to here. Like, you know, we don't want to send our money. We don't want to help those, especially the minorities. Who are the minorities? The ones that came over and filmed, the blacks. Like, you know, we don't want to help them. We want to help the ones that's doing something. Let's help the suburban areas. We don't want to help the inner city areas. Do what they're going to do. All they're going to do is multiply, have babies, sell drugs, be off drugs, and have guns and kill each other in the community.
I want to ask how important it is for you all to tell your own narratives. And I ask that question because you've been live streaming this entire conversation.
It's just because of what has happened with the BBC. We definitely don't want something to get misconstrued or reported wrong, or just because I'm like the face of probably about 300 memes right now, and all of them are seriously negative. My kids are like, whoa. So I just want everything to be, you know, where I can go back and say, uh-uh, that didn't happen, or that's the truth, that ain't, or, you know.
LaToya, for you.
Oh, here we go.
LaToya didn't want me to ask her questions, but I'm curious to pick her brain. Just how do you go about building trust with people that you're reporting on and holding yourself accountable when you're doing a story?
One, I try not to drop in and drop out, right? So if I'm with you, I'm not coming to talk to you for 5 minutes and then saying, okay, I have to go, right? I want to know who you are, the good and the bad. And I want to be able to, like I said, portray you as a whole person. And then not only that, typically after my story's there, I follow up with you. I send it to you. And I say, hey, here it is. Please let me know what you think. I'm saying, hey, I live in this community. You're a part of this community. We need to work together because I'm not going anywhere and neither are you. So let's build this relationship.
Also, you might see the person next week. Milwaukee's small.
Yeah. It's like I have nowhere to go, right? And I don't want anyone coming. Not only is it that I don't want someone coming after me, but I think that, I mean, I take my job seriously. What about you? Let's turn the tables.
I mean, I think I came into this work critical of journalism. And so I kind of enter with just an awareness of how damaging stories can be, especially to communities of color or to just any marginalized community. And so I think I spend a lot of time and angst sort of making sure that I do it right and making sure that I'm representing someone fully. I think that's sort of the word that I keep coming back to is like that idea of like how do you, because there's good and there's bad and it's all of these things, and like how do you tell a full picture mm-hmm. of what's going on and do it with like care and compassion.
I'm from Flint, Michigan. There's this documentary called Roger and Me, right? Roger and Me was about the downfall of General Motors. My entire family worked for General Motors. But this was, I don't know, in the 80s. I think maybe early 90s, that this documentary was made by Michael Moore. And so in this documentary, there's this scene where he shows this person skinning a rabbit. I have never in my life, especially back then, seen anyone skinning a rabbit in Flint, Michigan, right? And so I look at that, and I've always said, as a journalist, to find that one person doing that one thing, it's like, yes, as a person from that community, I look and I say, how sensational. So wherever it is that I work, I also live, and I think of that as my community. So I don't want to just be that journalist, right? I want to be that community member as well. And I always look at it from that viewpoint.
Let's show what they neglected to show. Let's show the real Milwaukee, you know, and the people that are in it that are changing lives, that have changed their lives, that have children, that are mothers, fathers, and really out here doing our best to make a difference.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks.
That was WUWM's LaToya Dennis and Aisha Turner speaking with Shonda Payne and Thaddeus Ashford, two of the people featured in the BBC documentary Murder in Milwaukee.
Payne and Ashford are planning to work with other community activists to put together their own documentary about life in Milwaukee, one that will be told in their own words.
Support for race and ethnicity reporting is provided by the Ramaya Family Foundation.
Coming up next, our Fit for You segment explores the mindfulness practice known as dynamic running therapy. That's next when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. When we feel mentally or emotionally stuck, most of us intuitively know we'll feel better if we go outside for a walk. Letting your mind wander as your body moves often has a positive effect on mood.
William Pullen is a psychotherapist based in London. It was during a crisis in his own life that he discovered how much help running was in working through his feelings. He then began adding movement to the other therapeutic techniques he was already using with his patients and found it helped them as well. And now he's written a book for the rest of us called Running with Mindfulness: Dynamic Running Therapy to Improve Low Mood, Anxiety, Stress, and Depression.
Dynamic Running Therapy, or DRT, is a simple and intuitive therapeutic method that helps people through mindful movement. For this month's Fit for You, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski reached Pullen by Skype from London to find out more. Pullen starts by explaining dynamic running therapy and how it came about.
DRT is a kind of therapy which, instead of sitting with my clients inside of a consultation room, I run with them. And apart from that, it's quite similar to regular talk therapy in an office. But I'm using the body in all sorts of different ways, which I'll get into later on. In terms of how it came about, it came about from my own discovery of how powerful running could be to address feelings during a period of crisis in my own life many years ago.
Many of us perhaps exercise or go for runs regularly, but rarely do we maybe think about the mental aspects and elements and also benefits. So what is the importance of movement overall in our lives, whether we're running or just take the time to go for a walk?
Well, you know, over here, probably like over there, we talk about sitting being the new smoking. I mean, movement is so natural. You know, I love that saying, if you're not evolving, you're dying. You should be always growing and moving and living and sharing and creating, and then you can rest in between. But when you're stagnant, stagnation is what leads to depression. Stagnation is what leads to illnesses of the spirit and mind, soul, body, everything.
You mentioned in your book the Japanese practice of Shinrin Yoku, and that nature and our desire to connect with it is hereditary. So can you speak on that a little more?
Well, so, you know, we are hunter-gatherers, aren't we? Our DNA is still telling us that we're hunter-gatherers. It still wants us to go out there and spend several hours a day. Our minds, our hormones are wired up for community so that we can go out and hunt together, hunt for animals, hunt for shelter, hunt for safety together. We're supposed to be out there doing things and exploring things and so forth. So I think that's why it's written into our DNA the way it is.
And with today's advanced world, obviously, we're not primarily working on our own land or anything like that. We're often stuck in a work building or at home. Perhaps people are lucky enough to go camping for a weekend or something like that. But what's a way we can connect with nature if, like most of the global population, we are stuck in the pattern of being at home indoors and then work indoors?
Well, just get out, you know, get out as best you can. I'm here in London, and trust me, London's pretty landlocked too. But there's a river, and I walk down to the river, and that helps me. And I try to walk along it some evenings. There are parks here I go to. I try to walk to work and walk back from work. I bicycle places. There are, you know, cars are the big enemy. If you can find a way to leave your car in your garage, and just walk to work, it's just fantastic. If it's possible, I know it's not for everybody. Or take the bus, even anything that's different from just sitting in that car in traffic.
This book is not only about being mindful in running, but it uses tools and exercises to address situations in our life or even with low mood, anxiety, depression. So how would you recommend using DRT for these different types of issues in people's lives?
Well, as long as you can walk or better still run a little bit, and it's a great, if you don't run, it's a great opportunity to learn how to run. It's good for anybody, I think. You know, anybody who suffers from anxiety, there's a whole DRT journey. It takes you on a sort of before, middle, and after kind of journey. And it's the same for depression and anger, relationship issues. There are a series, there's a program where you explore your relationship with yourself, your relationship with your condition, and make some progress.
In this book, you have spaces for a person to write down their own thoughts, experiences, or even just document how they're feeling or what they notice as it goes along. Did you find this most helpful when you were developing it, or is it a tool you always use with your clients that you thought would be useful to apply after people go for that walk or that run?
Well, you know, I'm a huge believer in journaling. In my own experience, I find that it gives me, in my private life, I find that it gives me clarity. I find it as a place, repository, somewhere I can put, you know, difficult and overwhelming feelings. I write them down, and afterwards I feel better. So I incorporated it into DRT because I think it's a fantastic way to make sense of what's happening in your life.
Now, I have to admit, with mindfulness, I was having a hard time wrapping my head around it because in my experience, when I go for a run, I'm doing it to not think about something, to get into that blank state of mind. So in my mind, I was getting a little anxious. I was like, isn't this counterintuitive to, you know, set out with a question or a problem that someone may have? And you mentioned acknowledging your thoughts as they come to you and then let them go.
Yep.
You know, is this helpful in finding a solution to the question we're seeking if we acknowledge thoughts and then let them go and carry on?
I believe it is. Well, I think we're talking about two different things here, because there's the mindful run and mindful walking, and that's where I'm suggesting that you keep on coming back mindfully, mindfulness practice, where you're coming back to your breathing, back to different sensations and away from your thought, gently allowing your thoughts pass. That's different from the program in the book, which are about moving through a bunch of questions and using running to those questions of what comes up for you, how your body responds to those particular questions, watching your emotional response to them. Am I judgmental? Am I mindful? Am I self-accepting? Is this into ideas about myself, you know, that are historical, etc.? So do you see the difference?
Yes, yeah. I suppose another one of my questions kind of along that lines is, you know, for athletes or people who exercise and run regularly and run with the goal of speed in mind, or perhaps they're training for a marathon, do you think applying a mindful run is counterintuitive to that, or do you think it's best to do your training runs for the physicality separately and save perhaps rest days or walking or an easy run to practice DRT?
No, I think there's a place for it, unquestionably, for mindful running as part of training. You know, as you do in all mindfulness, you're trying to get out of your mind and into a sort of connection with your body and your environment, so that you're not obsessing about the past, the present, the future, just what there is instead of what there could be or might be, or you don't want there to be, or what you're apprehensive about or what you regret. Just be here now with what is. And so when you run with that, you should be able to concentrate on whatever it is you've picked out as your methods. And I'm going to count trees. I'm going to watch the flowers. I'm going to feel the air and on my face. I'm going to listen to sounds. I'm going to count my footfalls. With that simple thing, with practice, you'll find that just becomes automatic. And so you are present. In answer to your question about the training piece, part of what happens when I run and when I'm training is I notice that my first doubts about my ability to run further or faster come up in my mind, triggered by my body. But then they come up into my mind, and there they sort of percolate until they finally overcome whatever will I may have. This is a way of saying, hang on, that's in my mind. It may have originated in my body, but now it's in my mind. And should I allow every thought that's in my mind to inform who I am? I am not my fears. I am not my thoughts. They come, they go. So in that way, I'm able to say, look, there's a thought. It's telling me, oh, I think you're tired. You should think about giving up right now. Well, you go, yes, that's a thought. Let me let that go. Let me look to see what my body's doing instead, what the wind is doing, what the flowers are doing. Do you see?
Yes. And along those lines, you state that one of the main goals is to acknowledge and befriend your inner critic. And spending time alone with ourselves can be intimidating to most people. So what kind of advice would you recommend in building up to being accepting of yourself and your thoughts with DRT, with setting out on a walk or run and accepting that this is just for you?
That intimidation you've just talked about, it's exactly what you should be working with. It's a bit like the mindfulness where people go, I can't concentrate, you know, I'm terrible at this. I keep on thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch. Well, that is mindfulness. There's a reason you're doing that, because lunch is coming up and it's okay. So just let go. In other words, accept. By accepting that you are concerned about lunch or something much larger, you're able to validate the experience and let it move on so you can come back. If I tell myself instead, oh God, you know, here I am failing at this again, thinking about lunch 15 times in this 10-minute meditation, I'm no good at this, I've never been any good, I'll never be any good, then we perpetuate the problem. So that's how you befriend your inner critic, is you make peace with it. You become aware of the process. That's really important. The book talks a lot about that. Just to notice what you're doing, and then to meet it with gentleness, to meet it with understanding, compassion, to validate its right to exist instead of trying to fix or avoid.
You also mentioned in your book that DRT can be done either alone or with a partner. So I'm curious, what advice do you have to best balance inner criticism and also make yourself vulnerable with another person? And can you explain the listener and sharing roles if you do this with a partner?
Yes, well, you would very much take it in turns. Let's say that you buy the book and you want to go running with your friend, and you're going to discuss your marriage and they're going to discuss their career. Well, then you agree beforehand that today's all about you, or the first half an hour of the run is about you, and then you switch roles. So you'll be talking, they'll be listening, then they'll be talking, you'll be listening. During that period, their job is to learn how to listen to you well. And that means, and the book goes into this, how to actively listen. Likewise, your job is to try to learn how to open up. And that, by the way, is one of the many, many different aspects of DRT that make it so powerful, is that it helps us. It loosens up the tongue. We're moving side by side with somebody. We're on a journey. And as I'm sure you've experienced on road trips, you find yourself just sharing intimate things, and it flows and it flows. And that's a fantastic part of running or walking. It gets our stories up and out. And if we're stuck in our life, if we're depressed, if we're anxious, it gives us a way to both burn off the anxiety, to cure some of the depression with healthy outside. But most of all, it gives us a method to say, look, I'm doing something about this. Today I got from A to B. And in this way, I'm addressing the anxiety, the helplessness that I feel. And, you know, often we feel helpless, don't we? We don't know how to address it. Well, this is a way to address it with your body.
With the additional benefit of exercise and being in nature.
Yes, and with somebody, and you know, I do say you need to be careful about who you choose to go on these journeys with. DRT is powerful, you know, it's as powerful as you want, as you let it be. And so that means you may end up very emotional, you may end up very angry. And so there are all sorts of things you want to check out first with the person that you're going to be going on this journey with. But my goodness, from my personal experience, when I sort of developed it and during my training, it really was miraculous. Because I do it every day, I find it miraculous even today. Running is a creative process. It's a healing process. Getting out, sharing. I think there's something different about sitting down and telling a story and moving while telling a story. I don't think stories are really best told when sitting down. I think they become sort of, we become too conscious of our face, of how we appear, whether we're boring the other person. When we're running, we're just distracted enough and we're just engaged enough to keep it moving. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, I certainly hope we can encourage some other people to use movement and mindfulness and DRT best in their own lives. And I want to thank you, William Pullen, for taking the time to speak about it today.
Thank you, Audrey. It's been a pleasure.
William Pullen is a psychotherapist based in London. He's the author of Running with Mindfulness, Dynamic Running Therapy to Improve Low Mood, Anxiety, Stress, and Depression. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find out more information about DRT at WUWM.com.
Cat behavior expert Jackson Galaxy returns to Milwaukee this Wednesday. We'll get a preview of his new book when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Anyone who has ever interacted with a cat can tell you they can be perplexing animals. But cat behaviorist Jackson Galaxy would argue that a lot of that confusion comes from what he terms looking at cats through dog-colored glasses.
Galaxy is the host of My Cat from Hell on Animal Planet, and his new book, Total Cat Mojo, is a complete guide to understanding the felines in your life. Galaxy will be in Milwaukee this Wednesday for an event at Turner Hall, but I had a chance to speak with him over the phone before his trip. Jackson Galaxy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
So this isn't your first foray into book writing. You have this new book, Total Cat Mojo, but it does seem to be pretty different from your previous books. How do you compare it to your books like Catify, To Satisfy, or Catification?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the other books would sort of gloss over the whole shebang, and really, Total Cat Mojo is the whole shebang. I mean, it's pretty much everything I know about cats in one place, which was a really scary undertaking, I got to tell you. I mean, it was a tough thing to put down, you know. But no, the other ones, you know, for instance, Catification was really about designing, you know, your home for cats. Catify, To Satisfy, a follow-up. And Cat Daddy was a memoir, but it had helpful tips throughout. And this one is really soup to nuts, you know. It's everything I know.
How did you compile this information? How did you weed out what you felt like didn't need to be there and put in really the information that any cat owner needs to know?
Well, for me, you know, when I first started not just learning about cats, but teaching about cats, a lot of it was about, you know, how to get it into a form that could easily be digested by people, because honestly, cats are so unknowable, you know, to so many people as opposed to dogs. So I really tried to narrow it down and try to give people this starting point. And the concept of Cat Mojo was that starting point. And that is this concept of the utmost confidence that a cat can have. And that's based in their sort of natural state, you know, what I call the raw cat, and everything that feeds into that. And so the whole book became this, as long as it had something to do with mojo, it was going in the book. As long as I could connect it to confidence and to, you know, a cat's natural sense of being and a place in the world, then that's what went in there.
You do use this term, mojo, cat mojo. How do you define that, and what does it really encompass?
Cat mojo is, and it's funny because there's a whole chapter in the book where I start talking about doing this speech in, I think it was in Colombia or Argentina, and I was talking through a translator. And I start talking about the concept of mojo, and all of a sudden there's crickets, like nobody was getting it. And I suddenly realized that nobody understood what the term mojo meant. I always thought that the concept of mojo was sort of this thing that everybody knew, like, you know, I got my mojo working, you know, that kind of thing, but nobody did. So mojo is when you say I've got my mojo working, I got my mojo on, it's like this natural swagger. It's this natural sense of confidence, not cockiness, just an inner sense of confidence that radiates out to the rest of the world. And the example I use is John Travolta at the beginning of Saturday Night Fever walking down the street. And like, he's got that natural strut because the guy owns Brooklyn, you know. Cats own space if they're allowed to play into the things that their ancestors would need, which is, you know, the concept of territory is sacred, and I need to have pieces of that territory in order to feel that I own it. And the second thing is their natural need to wake up in the morning, hunt, catch, kill, and eat. Now, if they can't do that, which living in your apartment, we would hope they can't do that, then what we do to replace that need in a more acceptable way to humans is what feeds into that mojo. So again, it's about confidence. I mean, don't forget, cats are here for one reason. They have stayed along with us for tens of thousands of years, not because they were pets, but because they did a job. And that job was to kill other things. And they did it really well, and they continue to do it well. So as they transition into this world of being pets in people's homes and apartments, we still have to feed the beast, as it were. And of course, there's creative ways to do it. And that's a lot of what this book is about.
You know, you mentioned before about cats, of course, being compared to dogs. And you often hear people say things like, you know, well, I'm not a cat person, or I really don't get cats. And there does seem to be this kind of this disconnect between people and cats specifically. What are some of the barriers that people seem to have in communicating with cats in general?
The biggest thing is what I call looking at cats through dog-colored glasses. I mean, we expect cats to act like dogs. And other than the fact that they have four legs and they live in our house, that's really where it ends. I mean, dogs we have built to act the way we recognize, to do things for us, to look to us for appreciation, love, and cats don't. It wasn't what we had them around to do. We really didn't selectively breed cats for certain behaviors all these years. So it's really important to look at a cat for what they are, which is, in my point of view, a barely domesticated animal living in your house. And as such, and this is the tough part for a lot of people, you have to compromise with a cat in order to have a good life with them. And that's, like I said, that's kind of tough for people to swallow.
Yeah, what are the kinds of issues that this kind of miscommunication can cause with cats and their owners?
You know, one of the things about the sort of inscrutability that cats have always sort of had with humans is that we then project our worst traits onto them. So if a cat's sitting there staring at you and you happen to have had a bad day, you can easily go to "the cat hates me," because you don't know what else you're looking for, you know? And then, God forbid, the cat does something like pee in your shoe, you know, it's all bets off. And all of a sudden, they're the worst animal. They're the worst pet. They hate you. They hate the family. They, you know, and we dive off into this projection deep end that's part of what I think my job is to have you step away from that. And if you understand them from motivations to body language, then you have a different starting point, which will hopefully give you more patience and more empathy with the animal that you live with.
So when you're talking to people about their cats, whether it's on the television show or just in life in general, what are some of the common behaviors that people find really mystifying?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have a job if it weren't for cats peeing and pooping outside the box. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's pee and poop, blood and guts. I mean, if it's aggression or litter box behavior, that's what stumps people. And that's the way the cats act out the most. So, you know, it's those things. I mean, there is no greater insult to a human being than to have a cat pee on your stuff, or that you're petting a cat and suddenly they turn on you and bite you. And it's always random, or it's out of the blue, and I didn't do anything, and why does my cat hate me? And again, my hope is you read this book and that phrase will never come out of your mouth again. You know, it was out of the blue. It was random. You know, that kind of thing.
Now, there are a lot of misconceptions, I think, about cats in general, ranging from, like, folklore about them being evil or stealing the spirits of babies, which is an actual folklore. But there are others that are still pretty detrimental, even if they aren't sort of mystical in that way. What are some of these common misconceptions?
Well, I mean, the sense that cats are solitary and aloof, I think, is one of the biggest ones. You know, and God knows the world of cartoons and such, you know, such things have really propagated that. But honestly, it's not the case. Cats are incredibly social animals. They don't live by themselves out in the wild. They live in colonies. They even nurse each other's young. They're very communal minded. The only thing that cats do in a solitary way is hunt. Other than that, they need company. So the way they need and the way they show that need is completely different from the way a dog does it. And that's really where we have to start again, that a cat's not a dog.
What are some of their unique emotional needs? Because as you said, they do come off as being aloof, as not wanting that kind of community.
But again, I think that the reason we're saying that is because we're thinking of dogs. So when we think of a dog wanting something, we think of the big wagging tail and the sort of slobbering and the panting really, really hard and their ears going down and looking really cute at you and pawing at you. And that's how we say, my dog loves me, my dog wants my attention. And because cats just don't express that way, we go the other end. Cats are, in terms of communication, they're much quieter. They don't demand the way dogs demand, and they don't expect what dogs expect, you know? I mean, I know I'm painting this with a huge brush, but what we call aloof is only in place because of that comparative place that we start from. For instance, you know, this whole thing that I've talked about for years, the cat I love you, or the slow blink, that is my way of breaking the ice with a cat, that a slow, soft blink that they then return to you is a way of them saying, I trust you. I love you. I trust you. And for a wild animal to close their eyes to what could be prey or predator is a huge thing, you know? Another example is what I call the cat hug, which is a cat who rolls on their back for you. Now, is that an invitation to rub their belly? No. And then you're going to find out because they're going to scratch you when you try to rub their belly. But again, that show of vulnerability, that show of that center line, which in the wild, you show any animal that center line and you risk being completely eviscerated. That show is the ultimate trust for an animal that lives by their wits, who is right in the middle of the food chain. We have to remember who we're living with, you know?
So who do you think is the audience for Total Cat Mojo? Is it someone who's just gotten a cat, who might be getting a cat, or is it someone who has a lot of experience?
Everybody. Honestly, I don't usually toot my horn about things. I really don't. This book, to me, is what I get to sort of leave behind. I mean, I'm probably not going to write another book for a while. This was sort of everything that I could give everybody. And that means whether you've never had a cat before, whether you're afraid of cats, whether you hate cats, because I know that I can get you past that place, or whether you've had cats all your life, I know that there's something that you can walk away with that you didn't have before. The most important thing that I weave throughout the book is the concept of relationship. The concept that you don't own a cat. They're not just something you have. It's a relationship that you're in. And cats do mirror a lot of human relationships. And for instance, if you want to have a successful relationship with a human, you have to be prepared to compromise, to listen when you don't feel like it, to actually bend in a way that is inconvenient to you. A successful relationship with a cat demands the same. And I know that sounds kind of, you know, maybe over the top a little bit, but the bottom line is the payoff is huge. And it's not just about getting a cat not to pee on stuff or not to be aggressive. It's a level of connection that I have found is so incredibly deep. And that's the payoff, you know, it's a lifelong relationship. And I think that if we start to approach living with cats, or any animal for that matter, as a relationship, good things happen and bad things are less apt to happen.
Well, Jackson Galaxy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
It's been my pleasure, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Jackson Galaxy is the author of Total Cat Mojo, and he's the host of My Cat from Hell on Animal Planet. He'll be in Milwaukee this Wednesday, November 1st, for an event at Turner Hall. There is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It is 11 o'clock.